effective way of really engaging these people. I mean, I have tried, and of course,
I sometimes send back emails pointing out where the things they say are absolutely ridiculous, and they ought not to be saying them. But
yeah,
that doesn't. It hasn't done a thing. I mean, they keep forwarding the emails. They don't check. They don't do any source checking. And all these emails are in these characters that are that high on your screen.
Yeah, so you can...
It's like, I'm going to shout at you what this is. And I say, look, if you ever get an email that says forward it to everyone in your mailbox, and it has great big letters in it, it's a hoax. Don't send it. Keep doing it.
I mean, I've struggle trying to figure out good strategies. I've found that if they're engageable, I can usually start with some questions like, what do you mean the second story? And even if it's very, very apparent within seconds, if they're just emotionally driven, be thoughtful and want to. I can appreciate the fact that I don't call you through, it's radical. But you can sit there and you can
And I think it's better for everybody.
Yes.
For questions.
It must be.
I just want to tell the people that are in this room that we are going to begin on time in 1 minute. So if you have conversations, take them elsewhere. Move up front if you're going to stay. And otherwise, we will just move right ahead. Of the convention. It is my pleasure to welcome you to this session of the Sunstone Symposium and also to invite you to turn off your cell phones at this point. I can't think it's a problem with this group. It would just make a nice little thing on the side. And we will be discussing in this session Paul Ayer's new book, Mormon Convert, Mormon Defector. I've heard him on cell phone. This is a very interesting and well-written book that addresses a situation seldom recognized by Mormons. That there were people who converted to the church with great enthusiasm, but who, after spending some time in Brigham Young's highly regimented state, decided that they did not want to stay and left. However they could, often as Polly's relative Peter McCausland did, under the protection of the military. Getting to Zion was hard. Leaving Zion was pretty hard, too. And this is of interest to me because my very own great-great-grandfather, Joseph Venables Vernon, was likewise disenchanted. Vernon was a dashing engineer. He heard the gospel in 1851 from John Taylor, His daughter remembered being awakened and wrapped in a blanket and taken down to the drawing room to hear John Taylor tell of the martyrdom of the prophet and his part on that awful occasion. All the family and the servants were in the room and heard the thrilling recital. He only and his eldest daughter joined the Mormons. His wife was bitter and never did. Then Vernon felt he had to gather to Utah. His wife would let him go alone before she would accept Mormonism, which in despair he did. He thought his family would join him later in the valley. And so, in effect, he abandoned his family. His oldest daughter, Chrissy, was then 21. His youngest son, Horatio, just 2. And he left to join a despised sect, leaving the family when they most needed him. His wife never forgave him. He left England with President John Taylor in 1852, and they traveled with the machinery for the sugar factory. The sugar business was a failure, as you all know, and a great financial loss. In Salt Lake, Vernon seemed totally unable to cope with the life of the pioneer time. But he was a good speaker. He addressed the saints in March 1856, 4 years after arriving in the valley, in the old tabernacle. President Brigham Young said, "Whenever I hear Brother Vernon speak, I am always reminded of the music of well-tuned strings." I think he means violins. Vernon arrived in the Salt Lake Valley in 1852. He gave the speech in 56, and in 59, he fled from the valley by night. What happened to Vernon in those years between his tabernacle address in 56 and 1859? He had married polygamously, cutting off all ties with his first family and fathered another daughter. His fortune dwindled. He crossed some line, and probably being watched, he left by stealth. He fled first to San Francisco, then to Honolulu, where he died a disappointed and broken man, long since a stranger to Mormonism. Well, this story has been a puzzle to his descendants, who came back into the church 2 generations later. I never heard of another case until recently. So much for my introduction, which is to say that, as far as I know, Pauli's book is the first entry in this new genre, the disaffected member. And so today we are discussing that. I've just received word from the Western Writers of America that Mormon Convert, this book we're discussing today, was the finalist for the Spur Award for Best Nonfiction Biography. This is quite an honor for Pauli, an independent historian who lives in Seattle, Washington. She's a member of the editorial board of the Journal of Mormon History and has written prize-winning articles for that and for other journals. And besides Mormon Convert, Mormon Defector, which I believe is her first book, yes. Is that right? All right, she is co-editor with Jeffrey Nichols and Winnie Bagley of Playing with Shadows, Voices of Dissent in the Mormon West, a forthcoming volume in the Kingdom of the West series to be published by Arthur H. Clarke Company. That will be another addition to this new genre. Critics today, and I will announce them, introduce them all at this point, and then we'll just continue with the discussion until we get to time for, I won't come up again until it's time for our question period. But I want to introduce our 2 critics. The first is Angela Breland, a promising and well-informed young scholar who is in the process of completing a degree in history at Utah Valley University. She's currently researching Mormon midwifery in the late 19th century, and she has become part of the Claremont Graduate School community, even as her husband is here and is working on a degree. Todd Compton opened another important genre with his serious consideration of Joseph Smith's many wives in Sacred Loneliness, The Plural Wives of Joseph Smith, which was published in 1997. He is also co-editor of A Widow's Tale, the 1884-1896 diary of Helen Marr Kimball Whitney, which was published in 2003. In this later account of Whitney's life, she leaves out her earlier name, Smith, because she was Joseph Smith's infamous 14-year-old bride before that. He is also co-author of Fire and Sword, A History of the Latter-day Saints in Northern Missouri, 1835-39, which he hopes will be out this summer. I hope so too, or this year anyway. He's researching a biography of Jacob Hamblin, the Indian missionary. And he's married to Laura Compton. They're the parents of two boys. And so I'd now like to call on Angela to come to this place and give her critique.
I am thankful for Polly for giving me this opportunity, as I am somewhat new to both the world of academia and Mormon history. While researching Mormon midwifery, I have written many journals, diaries, record books, and correspondences from the 1850s. And I had heard of Blood Atonement, not from what I read, but from other sources. But I was woefully unprepared, I think, for the amount of violence in the form of castration, murder, and intimidation discussed in Polyeer's book, Mormon Convert, Mormon Defector. I did not grasp the extent that such a teaching played in Mormon history, or what that could have meant to the testimonies and faith of the members. And as I was reading about Peter McCausland, I was struck by the discrepancy between his expectations and reality, and how he reacted to those differences. And I do have to add that I was brought to repentance for ignoring the people that didn't stick, that weren't able to stick it out for whatever reasons. And I think that as I was reading this biography, I felt that I could learn more about my own membership in the church through those people. But Polly has created an engaging narrative through an inclusive and comprehensive history where she lays out the political, economic, and religious life in Scotland. She molds her narrative around the McCausland family so we can see how they would have been affected, what their political leanings would have been, as well as a sense of their personalities. Even though young Peter McCausland, the focus of the book, is quite often not directly mentioned, Polly conveys how he would have been swept along in the tide of changes and events in his community and family. From Scotland, across the Atlantic, up the Mississippi, and finally to Utah, Polly provides detailed descriptions of what Peter most likely saw and experienced. The McCausland's come across as a family deeply devoted to one another and also to their religious convictions. They seem to be consistent in their support of a particular church in Scotland. So while they may have had fundamental disagreements about social hierarchy and social injustices, their devotion and conviction help maintain a relationship with that church. One would not think they would lightly give up relationships. The McCausland's seem to be people that did not easily change their allegiances. There must have been something extra special about Mormonism for them to convert. Polly provides insight into the conversion process of the Scottish saints. She begins her discussion of Scotland with an introduction to the accepted idea that society follows hierarchical patterns and the political turmoil that began to roll through the working class, who were rejecting the idea that their lot in life was divinely ordered. At the same time, wages were low and continued to fall, and employment was scarce. As traditional family and community structures were rapidly changing, people reached for either the drink or religion to fill the gap created by strained relationships and long demanding work hours. The McCausland's looked to religion to ease the hardships of their working class lives, but that would also become unstable. Divisions formed in the churches, those who accepted the hierarchical way of life essentially supporting the status quo and those who were demanding progress. Amidst this strife, inequality, poverty, and hardship, the Mormon missionaries arrived with a message of equality and prosperity and freedom from an unfair system. A Scottish convert put it like this: they invite their hearer to fly from oppression to that happy land where the poor are lords of the soil, where no cruel mill owners can trample on their rights of labor, where social inequalities are unknown, and where all the citizens are united by the bonds of a universal brotherhood and a common faith. Polly makes it easy to understand what it was about Mormonism that became so intriguing and welcoming to the McCausland's and other Scots. It is easy for me, as a Latter-day Saint, to think, well, they heard the truth. They clearly felt the Spirit. But understanding the mass conversions in the context of political and social inequality, economic disparity with little to no hope of progression, and religious strife and disagreements provides the reader with a better understanding that converts thought Mormonism would rectify the evils in their lives. Scots were not being taught the message of forever families, but social and economic justice. Mormonism was not just a religion, but it was a community built on brotherly love, justice, and freedom. Peter McCausland, however, began early on to experience disappointments in his new religion, or at least in the people. In Scotland, there was an issue with the mission president misusing money. People that spoke out against him were cut off from the church for a time. Another experience was during the riverboat trip up the Mississippi River. The leaders of the immigrant party, the elders, were able to secure cabins for themselves, while the rest of the group suffered unsanitary, cramped, and demeaning circumstances. They described themselves as cattle. On top of the detestable conditions, the immigrants were left without spiritual leadership as the elders neglected to lead them in song, prayer, or worship. Surely this affected McCausland, who was hoping to leave behind the system where money and status afforded individuals special treatment over others. Once in Utah, McCausland's fought drought, bugs, and starvation. They arrived to witness a terrible time in Mormon history where fanaticism reached extreme levels. The leadership of the church was convinced that they were not only fighting the national government, but also a pervasive evil that was corroding the saints. The crop failure and the bugs were clearly wrought because of unrighteousness. Blood atonement was preached from the pulpit, and the home teachers were assigned to assess the faithfulness of the saints. McCausland served in a quorum of 70 and was reprimanded for expressing a differing opinion. Some apostates who wanted to leave the church were murdered in order to save their souls, and there were some who were castrated for sexual sin. Pauli goes into great detail describing the murders and castrations, as well as the complete lack of investigation or prosecution. She illustrates the deep commitment, not to the faith, but in obeying authority. McCausland would eventually come to see the complete obedience to authority as relinquishing his agency and giving up his freedom. One can understand the disillusionment with a religion which was described as the cure for social problems, that it was the beginning of an era of peace, and to witness what would seem to most people as a complete breakdown of law and order and justice. I can imagine him thinking, as bad as things were in Scotland, at least I didn't have to worry about getting my throat slit. So, Pauli does a great job of eliciting emotion from the reader through the detailed narrative she created. I think that is a tremendous accomplishment, especially from a believing Mormon, who often finds herself thinking, yeah, but they should have stayed. They should have had more faith. Even Pauli describes Peter in similar terms. He did not persevere as most did. Well, I find myself wondering if my church was preaching a violent doctrine, or at least turning a blind eye, could I have plowed through? I don't know. And I can understand why McCausland became disenchanted with Mormonism, why he felt that they didn't have it right. And even though the Mormon me still says he should have stayed, the other side of me thinks, but how could he? Yet most did stay, including some of his own family. What made him different than others? They had similar experiences. They must have known about the violence. Was it simply a matter of faith or a lack of it? Does the belief in divine authority trump our sense of right and wrong? Do we give up our agency if we look aside, for it was done with authority? I asked myself these questions as I read about Peter McCausland. I did not feel that I could fault him for seeking a quiet life where he could live with his conscience, where he felt that he was progressing towards something better. And what of my own life? What, if anything, can be learned from the life, conversion, disenchantment, excommunication, and then later spiritualism of a man who trusted his conscience and joined a church and then left it because of the dictates of those same beliefs? I asked myself, will I have to answer for my actions regardless of who I am obeying? Will I be able to live with myself? Can I live up to the covenants I have made to obey? I have made if I obey. The very covenants that would demand my obedience will at the same time condemn me. The musical words of Jean Valjean ring true. If I speak, I am condemned. If I stay silent, I am damned. Luckily, the church has evolved somewhat in the last 250 years. I doubt that they will be asking members to shed blood anytime. But nevertheless, the members find themselves in situations where their conscience dictates opposite of what of church authority. And somehow that friction must be reconciled. Pauli presents this history in a fair and even tone. I think that with such sticky topics such as blood atonement, castration, murder, and censorship, she maintains equanimity and attempts to provide information as unbiased as possible. While she describes the Utah War, she allows Brigham Young his human side that acted out of fear and anger, and she succeeds in relating the discomfort people not of the fold might have suffered from Young's actions. While those who had suffered through Illinois and Missouri more than likely shared the same apprehension and fears as Young, others, such as the McCausland's, either did not fear the government or even view them as rescuers. Through her descriptions of the possible danger for non-Mormons as well as apostates, the reader can understand the threat of danger some groups might have felt by Young's actions that he felt were keeping his people safe. I wondered if Polly would have achieved such a friendly tone if it had not been for the favorable light that McCausland viewed the Mormons. While he was no longer a believer, he supported their endeavors to worship in their way and seek spirituality the way they felt best for them. I wondered if he had been more caustic in his memories and attitudes of Mormonism, if this book would have reflected that, or if there would have even been a book. I wondered about the legacy we leave for our descendants. Will our last remaining thoughts prove to trap our posterity in ignorance or bitterness? Or with an inability to look past our own hurts and disappointments at the larger and more complicated story of which we were only a part? Polly gave us the slightest insight into her family mythology and into her journey to find the truth behind it. I thought of this book not only as a history of an ancestor, but also as a quest to free oneself from incomplete or inaccurate history that surely serves to tempt perceptions. I wondered about the myths that have been passed down in my own family and what truths researching those would unearth. I am fascinated by that thought. Well, Polly mentions many themes that sprang from her book. I feel that this book is a treasure trove of themes that can be expanded. While those themes are not always explicitly stated, I feel that this is a positive aspect of the book. Polly does not attempt an evaluation of history, but the possibilities are there. The book touched on many themes that deserve further exploration. In the preface, Polly mentions some of these themes: the economy, society, and religious climate in Scotland at the beginning of the modern era, the remarkable missionary movement and immigration system established by the Mormons, the overseas and overland travel under that system, with its initiation into practical Mormonism, a theocracy in Utah and its violent overtones, such as the Utah War and the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and a risky flight to California that divided the family. In addition to those themes, or possibly as subsets to them, there is the idea of difference between dissenter and apostate, unquestioned obedience to leaders, and how that affects agency, disunity and disharmony created by class differences or economic disparity, belonging to a human church that claims to be divine led, and the line between obedience and mental, emotional, and spiritual slavery. I would think that it is a common question of the line between obedience and handing over one's agency. McCausland struggled with this question, as many do today. In the last 40 years, there have been instances where some would argue the church has stood in the wrong, or asked the people to back legislation that goes against their personal integrity, or to cease and desist writing on certain topics. I believe that members of the church struggle continually with obedience to authority and being true to their personal integrity. And my church membership has been questioned more than once by those who think that disagreeing makes me an apostate. It's a good thing I don't have to worry about my throat. So another question that McCausland experience brings up is the level of deference that we give to the hierarchy in the LDS Church. Should there be such a push for strict obedience? Is this a legacy born from false understandings of priesthood and its function that has been propagated through the centuries to demand absolute and unquestioning obedience? I have heard quite often, there is the church and there is the gospel. The church makes mistakes. Part of our problem is that we are not told or always know where the division between church and gospel is. Some would say that everything we are asked to do, then we do. When is it okay to disobey? And what of those that choose the path of defector over obedience? In order to be true to their religion and to their conscience, they might end up losing the society of Mormonism. To us in this day, our leaders preaching death and violence is unthinkable. It would never happen. Peter's story and that time seem extreme to us, but Mormons are still taught obedience to authority. Will we be seeking our Heavenly Father's forgiveness for things that we have done out of obedience and authority? I think that Peter's story brings up these questions.
I have to apologize. This response will be less an exhaustive review of this book than it will be a meditation on two issues that the book raised for me. Let me say at the outset, this is a wonderful book, beautifully written, exhaustively researched, extremely involving. If you don't know Polly, she's known Mormon, but she became immersed in Mormon culture and history while writing this book. And she almost seems to write from a Mormon viewpoint at times. In some stories or books, you know where the moment of high drama is. In this case, when Peter becomes disaffected from Mormonism, is alarmed by unexplained murders against ex-Mormons in his neighborhood, and escapes from Utah after the Utah War. And I put quotation marks around escapes. In many cases, the story leading up to such dramatic moments can be predictable and less than gripping. However, as I read this book, I was surprised how much I enjoyed reading the Scottish chapters with their account of Peter's struggle for economic survival in 19th century industrial Scotland. Crossing the ocean and crossing the plains, again, can be formulaic in many Mormon biographies. But Polly has done a superb job of bringing those experiences to life. I believe that anyone who reads these chapters will be stimulated by them and learn from them. I'm writing a biography of Jacob Hamblin in which Jacob crosses the plains, and reading Polly's treatment has already improved my chapter on the Overland Trail. One of the problems that most historians face is elucidating events or people who don't happen to have plentiful primary documentation. Cowardly, lazy historians, like Tom Alexander in his biography of Wilford Woodruff, or Leonard Arrington in his biography of Brigham Young, select figures who wrote extensive diaries and figure in the diaries of many other prominent people. Okay, I'm joking when I'm calling them cowardly, of course. Their subjects are difficult in different ways. However, when you try to write the biography of an ancestor or figure who didn't leave plentiful diaries or any diaries, you must piece together what puzzle pieces you have and add social history or the histories of people who were literal fellow travelers when available to fill out blank spaces. Polly has done a great job of filling in the gaps in the fairly meager writings of Peter McCausland. When we tell the story of rank-and-file people, we usually will not have the exhaustive documentation that an institutional leader like Wilford Woodruff had. But rank-and-file people are important, and Polly shows their experiences can be extremely involving. I don't have major negative criticisms of this book. However, occasionally I would have made minor stylistic changes. For example, on page 168 she writes, Raleigh described in his journal. It took me a few minutes to piece together who this Raleigh was. I had to go back a couple pages and work it out. On page 280, I would have added Bishop Raleigh to help the reader place him in his context. That's just an example of how minor my criticisms are. On page 285, she states that Peter was not an apostate, using the word in the sense of someone who actively battles against the former religion. I don't think that regular Mormons use apostate in this sense. They would consider anyone excommunicated to be an apostate. I will now turn to two issues that reading this book caused me to mull over. While I was attending UCLA, one day I was in the bookstore and saw a book of interviews with Wallace Stegner and looked through it. I found that there was a whole chapter on Mormons and Mormonism, not surprising given that Stegner had written two books on Mormons and had grown up, I think, mostly in Utah. Stegner naturally had nice and insightful things to say about Mormonism and Mormon culture. But one point that he made really struck me, and it was surprising to hear it from a writer so sympathetic to Mormons. The interviewer asked, what kind of lessons can or could Mormons learn from their history? And Stegner replied, if they really learn from their heritage, I suppose they would learn some other lessons that might not sit quite so well with the hierarchy. For instance, they could learn that the theocracy in Utah was a police state with a secret police and all the rest of it, which most won't grant. If they do grant, they just sort of wave it away, cover it over with dead leaves. But it's a very early example of theocracy ruled by priesthood. Existing on the frontier as it did, it had relative freedom of action for 10 years or so in Utah, which gave it a pretty stiff and rigid form. And it was hard to resist, and I should add that a lot of this happened during the time of the Reformation that Angela referred to, which was a period of great fanaticism. Existing on the Gentile literature about the destroying angel and the rest of it is lurid and exaggerated, but it's not based on myth. It's based upon a fact. There was such a guy as Hort Ruffalo. And Stegner went on to state that Brigham Young, as a successful practical colonizer, was a favorite of his friend, historian Bernard Devoto. But Stegner felt that Young, quote, is the one who is to be charged with all the secret police activities, with the destroying angels, possibly with the Mountain Meadows Massacre. A lot of things in Brigham's management of the Mormons after he got to Utah don't stand too close examination. Admiration has to be tempered all the time, I think, by a certain scrupulousness, which doesn't, unless you can admire a murderer, and he was accused of being accessory to a good many. So my admiration of Brigham Young is mixed, and my admiration for Joseph Smith is likewise mixed. But he preferred Smith to Young, he said. This is not an anti-Mormon like Sandra Tanner or Ed Decker speaking. This is a friend of the Mormons, a great novelist, and a fine historian. And this struck me forcibly at the time, and I realized that the mysterious murders of non-Mormons, liberal Mormons, or ex-Mormons in Utah in the years before and during the Utah War were a serious issue that Mormons needed to face. As Stegner put it, the story of these murders were an important, quote, lesson that Mormons needed to come to terms with. For Mormon historians, of course, this period of violence should be something they need to write about, and write about carefully and honestly. Stegner mentioned the difficulty of finding the complete truth about these murders. That is the common lot of history. He has also mentioned two extremes of inadequate ways of dealing with these issues. One is anti-Mormon sensationalism, on the one hand, and the other is, quote, wave it away, cover it over with dead leaves, unquote, on the other. Following this latter route, you ignore the issue, treat it like it is important if you deal with it at all. If you deal with it at all, you deal with it in a facile, shallow way, which is simply a way of perpetuating the cover-ups that have followed these murders in Mormon society and culture from the earliest times. Have mainstream Mormon historians looked at these events seriously and responsibly? My short answer is, I don't think they have. What Mormon historians have concerned themselves with the Parish Potter murders, the Aiken murders, and other lesser known murders? For the Aiken murders, Harold Schindler wrote a good biography of Porter Rockwell that deals with the subject, followed by a good article by David L. Bigler, neither of whom is exactly a BYU history professor. For the Parish Potter murders, the best scholarly treatments are now by Polly Eyre. This book, Mormon Convert, and her 2004 article, Do Nasty Apostates Clear Out? Reasons for Disaffection in the Late 1850s, which won the J. Talmadge Jones Award for Excellence from the Mormon History Association. Polly is a non-Mormon, also is not exactly a BYU history professor. Two recent important articles dealing with Utah war violence are Artist Partial, Pursue, Retake, and Punish, the 1857 Santa Clara Ambush, 2005, and William P. McKinnon, Lonely Bones, Leadership in Utah War Violence, 2007. Partial I would call a moderate Mormon. McKinnon is another non-Mormon. Two Mormons who have dealt with violence in 19th century Mormonism are Juanita Brooks, in her famous Mountain Meadows Massacre book, but also in her important edition of the Diaries of Hosea Stout. D. Michael Quinn in Mormon Hierarchy, Origins of Power and Extensions of Power. Juanita Brooks, again, was not exactly a BYU history professor, but was a historian who lived on the periphery, literally and figuratively. In Mike Quinn, we finally do have a BYU history professor. Though, of course, he was in effect fired from BYU and later excommunicated for writing history that was viewed as heretical by conservative church leaders. This is not meant to be a complete list, but these are some of the most important scholarly works on the subject. From what I would call Mormon historians, a deafening silence. Mainstream Mormon historians, a deafening silence. However, I'm pleased, and Wallace Stegner would be pleased, that some scholars are starting to look at the subject seriously, without sensationalism and animus on the one hand, and without whitewashing, oversimplifications, and sentimentalism on the other. I would like to emphasize that while the Parish Potter murders and some of these other acts of violence are an important moment in the psychic odyssey of Polly's protagonist, Peter McCossum, they and similar violence only take up a chapter or two in her 250 pages of text. But her treatment of the violence accompanying the Reformation and Utah War is excellent. Matter of fact, not sensationalized, yet not whitewashed. I suppose that the unspoken response of conservative Mormons would be that the murders, like the Parish Potter murders, were unsolved. However, Polly makes the point that in many cases these murders were not even investigated by the Mormon church leaders or the civil government controlled by Mormon leaders. When non-Mormons tried to investigate after the Utah War, Mormons did all they could to impede the investigations. In addition, these were not murders on the periphery of Mormon Utah that can be blamed on local leaders far from the church hierarchy. And Stegner, for one, believed that Brigham Young might have to bear responsibility for some of them. Okay, second issue. I was struck by how often Peter McCossum accused the saints of not thinking for themselves. Peter wrote to his sister that, let's see, that a true faithful saint in the Mormon church consists of to have no mind of your own. Practical Mormonism means, on the part of the subjects, blind obedience, unquestioning submission to authority. It made me wonder, if you have a prophet whom you accept as receiving revelation directly from heaven, does that allow you to disagree with the prophet? And to what extent can you disagree with him? While in church we emphasize the doctrine of following a living prophet, is it a necessary corollary of that position that when the prophet speaks, we must agree? Can we thoughtfully, carefully examine and weigh his statements, accepting some things as inspired and disagreeing with others? Last year, as we were entering the election season, preparing to vote on November 10th, our church president and his two counselors in the first presidency sent a message to all church members in California instructing us to support Proposition 8, which would make marriage of homosexuals illegal in a civil setting. President Monson and his counselors asked for as much financial support for Prop 8 as possible and for Mormons to actively go to door seeking turnout of conservatives to vote for the measure. I disagreed with Prop 8 for a number of reasons. First, I've never been able to follow the logic that says that allowing homosexuals to marry somehow detracts from full marriage rights for heterosexuals. Second, I was and am a committed Democrat, and Democrats tend to view this issue from the perspective of civil rights. Given that perspective, we tend to feel that homosexuals should have full civil rights, including the right to marry. Third, I saw that making support for Prop 8 the official church position would cause some LDS members who might be wavering between Democrat and Republican, some few church members who waver, might cause them to vote Republican. Karl Rove pushed opposition to gay marriage as a Republican get-out-the-vote issue during Bush's last election. Fourth, I have a lesbian friend who, with her partner, is raising children. She is a wonderful mother. Simply knowing someone like that makes you see the issue differently. I could go on, but that will give you an idea of my views on the subject. Here are some related experiences I had last year. I remember the Elders Quorum president in my ward giving a talk and saying that formerly he had been a live and let live kind of guy and would not have voted to ban gay marriage. But he said when the message of the first presidency was read in church, he realized that he needed to repent. There was no detailed convincing argumentation from the first presidency that won him over. Instead, there was simply a brief message directing Mormons to vote a certain way, and he quickly changed his point of view. After hearing the first presidency message read in my ward, I sent my state president an email asking if it was possible for a church member to thoughtfully and respectfully disagree with the first presidency on this issue. I mentioned some of the political ramifications of the issue, told him of my Democratic background. I asked him if church leaders above him had given him any guidance on whether church members could, based on deep convictions, not follow the church position seeking to ban gay marriage. I hoped that he would send me in writing what the church policy might be on that issue. I sent the email for a long time, no response, Finally, I got a call from you. And one of the reasons I sent it via email is I was hoping for something, you know, in print back. But I got a call. He was very non-confrontational and kind, but he did not directly answer my question. Instead, he tried to convince me that voting for Prop 8 was what the Brethren had asked for and was therefore right. I'm summarizing here, but that was how I remember the conversation. I thanked him for getting back to me and let the matter drop. In retrospect, I might have pursued my actual question further, but then it struck me that I might have been naive in asking the question in the first place. The instructions to support Prop 8 had come from a message of the First Presidency. How could a member disagree with a message of the First Presidency? I hope if the Church takes a political position again that it handles the situation differently, allowing typical Democrats and others some room to disagree and still feel comfortable in the Latter-day Saint community. So this issue, from the experience of Peter McCausland, are Mormons allowed to think for themselves in a culture in which a prophet heads the Church, is with us still. In conclusion, I am depressed by the fact that not many Mormons will read this wonderful biography, while hundreds of thousands of Latter-day Saints are reading Gerald Lund's whitewashed version of Mormon history. But I encourage everyone here to help remedy that situation by reading Mormon Convert, Mormon Defector yourself, and then recommending it to friends. Thank you.
First, I want to thank Claudia and Todd and Angela for their comments and being on this panel. Todd jokingly remarked that compared to Tom Alexander or Leonard Arrington, who wrote biographies of Mormon leaders and had an abundance of their writings to work with, plus another mountain of material by others about them, I've bravely undertaken to write a biography of an ordinary person who left little behind. I appreciate the compliment, but I have to admit that I was very naive when I started this project and had no idea how much I was biting off. I just had a family story that had a lot of dramatic elements to it, and I wanted to understand what had happened. Why were so many of my ancestors attracted to Mormonism in Scotland? What happened in Utah that led to their disillusionment? And then what? Was there a spiritual vacuum in their lives that they filled with something else? As I worked on this history, I came to believe ever more strongly that the experiences of the common folk, the rank and file, were equally as important as those of the leaders. Yet as I slowly collected my library of Mormon books, a necessity as I live in Seattle, far from a good Mormon collection, I realized that there are very, very few books about the ordinary member, and what there was seemed to be predominantly faith-promoting. So my calling became not only to tell Peter McCausland's story, but to redress an unbalanced situation. I am not saying that I wanted to write a faith-lowering book, no, but I wanted to write one that reflected McCausland's life with all its ups and downs, as every human life has, and not start out with an agenda. Both Todd and Angela have mentioned my making a distinction between an apostate and a defector. Todd is no doubt correct in saying that the average Mormon would label anyone who was excommunicated as apostate, and maybe even somebody who just left the faith without being excommunicated. I had an interesting exchange with Armin Moss on this subject, and he pointed me to a Wikipedia article on apostasy, which includes definitions that sociologists use. There is too much in the article to quote, but essentially sociologists define an apostate as one in a highly polarized situation whose total change in loyalties leads him or her to ally themselves with an oppositional coalition. The person becomes a professional enemy of the organization he left, speaking, writing, or in some way expressing outrage and the evil nature of the organization he left. In contrast, a defector is one who negotiates his exit with the organizational authorities. In an email to me, Armin clarified this. Quote, in today's LDS church, a defector would be exemplified by the many Mormons of recent decades who have simply walked away from the church, but especially those who have submitted letters of resignation. As long as they don't make public spectacles of their defection, they would be considered defectors, not apostates. Armin noted, quote, the ability of disaffected Mormons to just walk away or to formalize their defection in a letter of resignation is a fairly recent development. During my, Armin's, youth, and really until sometime around 1980, a formal excommunication was the only way one could leave the church and claim no longer to be a member. Otherwise, even if one moved to the East Coast and never went to church, home teachers would track them down sooner or later. Taking his and other sociologists' definitions into account, Peter McGoslin, although excommunicated, was more a defector than an apostate, in that he retained warm feelings toward the Mormon people and never wrote or spoke publicly against the church. On another subject, Angela makes the point that, quote, there were moments in the book where I felt that a more complicated history was skewed because of the needs to simplify and remain within the scope of McGoslin's experiences. She is correct. I was writing a biography, not a social history, and thus I was forced to look at what happened in Peter's life and around him that led him to become so disillusioned. Even Peter commented that the hard times had strengthened some in their faith. So what I have written is not the full story of life in that period, but rather what loomed as important to Peter that resulted in his losing faith. Turning to the issue of violence in the mid to late 1850s, Angela says she was woefully unprepared for the amount of violence that took place in that period. Todd notes that articles or books that delve into this period are almost all written by non-Mormons, and that, quote, from mainstream Mormon historians, a deafening silence. My experience has been that Mormons are generally ignorant of what happened in this period, except perhaps about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. They only know about the violence which was perpetrated on them at places like Hans Mill. But could Mormons themselves have initiated violence? Even knowledgeable Mormon historians are extremely uncomfortable when it comes to Mormon leaders promoting or just turning a blind eye to violence. And of course, especially if Brigham Young is even peripherally implicated. I've had Ron Walker, one of the authors of the recently published Massacre at Mountain Meadows, and a historian I much admire, tell me more than once that he really likes my work, but he just wishes I would do it on another subject. Actually, I have written about other subjects, about 19th century local missionaries in Scotland, and also about one emigrating scheme, how one emigrating scheme worked. Nevertheless, I think Ron is wrong. I believe Mormon historians have a duty to not pretend violence did not happen, and to realize the violence was different in character from that of the so-called Wild West. What happened in Utah, from the scattering of individual murders to the mass atrocity at Mountain Meadows, is not simply a peripheral aberration unworthy of study. The violence stemmed from a belief that the millennium was imminent, the day of judgment at hand, and that the Mormon people must be found pure. The preaching of blood atonement during the Reformation by church leaders was most likely an attempt to frighten people into reform, to buckle down and truly live as saints. But some local leaders took the words of their prophet literally and acted upon them. Some local bishops decided that they needed to purify their communities, to get rid of undesirables, and they believed they were doing what President Young wanted. The idea that the millennium was upon them is not trivial. Not a trivial peripheral subject. It should be studied. What did they believe at that time? How did they understand they should prepare themselves for it? Violence studied in this context can bring understanding. It can bring honesty to the history of Mormonism. And hopefully it would deter such an autocratic theocracy from ever arising again. As I am not LDS, I cannot speak in a practical way about the demand to follow a living prophet and what that means in terms of obedience and individual conscience. Angela sees the extreme choices Peter McGosselin faced could never happen today, but she adds that by looking at such extremes in the past, we can begin to look at our own times and how these questions are still with us, though in much more moderate terms. Todd's example here of Proposition 8 is very insightful. Peter McGosselin, the subject of my book, described sermons in which members were told to obey their leaders, whether right or wrong, that only through the priesthood could one gain salvation. To Peter, absolute obedience meant that one would then not use one's God-given ability to reason, and there would thus be an end to individual intellectual and moral development. He wrote, "The doctrine of doing as you are told, whether it appears to you to be right or wrong, was most strongly urged the last year or two that I was there, so much so I could not believe it. And of course I found out that I could not be consistently a Mormon." The question of authority versus conscience or individual agency is of course not limited to the Mormon Church. And as Todd points out, it is not just a historical problem. Finally, to Todd's suggestion that all of you here go out and read this book. I used to think that Mormons would want to read it out of curiosity, to see what I, a non-Mormon, had to say. But I've come to realize that the title may frighten some, that the book might somehow damage their testimony, or that someone might see them reading it and question what they were doing. I thus recently suggested to the publisher that he offer a dust jacket or some kind of book cover with Mormon convert printed in 48-point type and Mormon defector below in 8-point type. He reminded me that that most early copies of Juanita Brooks's book on the Mountain Meadows Massacre were sold packaged in brown paper bags. But all joking aside, I've encountered an interesting situation more than once through the years, and it perhaps touches on Angela's question of what kind of legacy are we leaving our descendants. The situation is that some make the assumption that if I, a non-Mormon, am writing Mormon history, it must be anti-Mormon in nature. The idea that if you are not for us, you are against us. The well-known and well-loved historian, Davis Fitton, somehow concluded I was anti-Mormon. Every time I ran into him at a Mormon History Association conference, he would whip around and walk quickly away. On the occasion or two when he couldn't because of circumstances, he reacted in his body language as if I were a serpent or maybe the devil incarnate. This truly bothered me. A couple of friends advised me to just forget it, that there was nothing I could do to change his opinion. But I finally resolved to try. During the next MHA and after the final banquet, I sought him out and said, "Davis, I just want you to know that I am not out to bash the church. It's just that I had a lot of ancestors who were once Mormons, but they left the church, and I'm trying to understand why." He looked at me with surprise and replied, "Oh, I didn't know." And after that, we were on cordial terms. He died a couple of years later, and I was glad I made the effort. I must point out that this assumption that I am anti-Mormon is not the common reaction I've experienced in the last 20 years. Most Mormons who come to MHA or Sunstone, or that I have met while doing research, have been more than welcoming, and some have become very good friends. Nevertheless, I sense a paranoia among a few, I don't know if I am right, but I see this as coming from all the stories Mormon children and adults are taught of the church's history as being a litany of one persecution after another. And then perhaps the person experienced some unfortunate incident that confirmed to them that Mormons truly are a persecuted people. Thus, I think I can understand why people might be suspicious of me, but truly, I have no interest in hurting the church. Rather, in some small way, I hope I can help bridge the gap between the insularity of Mormon culture and the broader society and bring some understanding to each side. Thank you.
Well, I hope that many of you will want to go out and read that Mormon Convert. And that you'll enjoy it as I've enjoyed reading it. However, even from these three reports today, criticisms, and also Polly's rejoinders to them, we have many interesting themes that have been raised which we can discuss. And so, what are some questions that we have we would like to put to these people? What are some of the comments that we would like to make? I am reminded by my instructions to have you ask your questions briefly enough that I can repeat them, or one of our commentators can repeat them, so that they will go on the record in an official way. All right, what do you have to say? Yes.
I have a brother-in-law who's serving a mission, and he sent home an email that said, I got some great advice in the MTC that no matter what your mission president says, even if you get a different answer when you pray, even if you read something different in the scriptures, that you obey it. That's the best advice. And it just scares me. And when I heard you guys talking about, you know, obeying your leaders, whether they're right or wrong, it's still happening. And I don't know what, I mean, I don't know what to say to him. I stopped emailing him because it just freaks me out a little bit.
All right, so we have some concern that the issue that people are told to obey the leaders of the church no matter what they have to say is still going on. Do we have comments on that? Do any of you want to make any comments on that?
Sure, I will. I was raised very conservative, and I was raised that when the leaders speak, you obey in it from, you know, whatever, your bishop on through the ranks and on down, possibly. And it's something that I think there is some I don't know. I was raised with that, and it's something that I have to struggle with. But I told my husband, I was in Spain during the Prop 8 thing, and he was here, and he had that issue. And I said, you know what? You can still obey your leaders, and you can still get out there and be involved. You don't have to tell people how to vote. You can just say, vote with your conscience. And you can say, you know, get educated about homosexuality and about these things, and they're not a pariah on our society, and they're good people, and it doesn't matter. And I think so when you're trying to figure out how to obey, they just say obey. They don't say exactly how to do it. I don't know. I struggle with that myself.
Let me just say briefly, I think, and I kind of hinted at this in my paper, I think this is something that, you know, the church needs to take some kind of official position on and say, in this, in some sections of what we say, there's room for disagreement. In other sections, there is no room for disagreement. And I think the church will be better off if it does take a solid position like that.
Well, that's interesting. We have ways to deal with this particular tension. I would be concerned, Todd, that, it would be a creeping thing. This is what you really have to do, would creep over into more and more sections, as we have known to do when anything is defined as moral. So I just think that might be dangerous in and of itself. But has anyone got another comment on that particular issue? Yes, Bill.
Claudia, I don't have a question. I do have a comment, and it runs to another reason why I think you ought to consider reading this book. I mean, I wrote the foreword in the course of doing that, thinking about the book. There's a dimension that goes beyond the titles, and it's Peter McCausland as Mormon, as a Scottish everyman, or as I think I indiscreetly described him as a Forrest Gump of the 19th century. I mean, this was a person who saw everything. He was in the throes of the Industrial Revolution at its worst, probably, in Scotland. He was in Great Britain during the Crimean War. He came to this country and stumbled in to the beginning of the Great Sioux War that went on for another 40 years. I mean, the death of the Mormon cow near Fort Laramie and the Grattan Massacre, which triggered off that 40 or 45 years of unremitting warfare with the Sioux and the U.S. government. He passed through like Forrest Gump, saw all kinds of things in Utah in addition to the Reformation. So it's a book that has, among other things, the tale of an average Scottish immigrant who happened to be Mormon. Most Scottish immigrants you read about are captains of industry, like Andrew Carnegie, or the lords of the cattle barons, or of the Northwest Company trading in the Pacific Northwest. That wasn't Peter McCausland. He was a very average guy in some respects, except when you delve into his character and his grit, you find him a very unusual person. But I think of him not only as a convert and a defector, but as Forrest Gump on the hoof, or on the loose in 19th century Scotland and America.
Right, he was a witness for his time. And Bill McKinnon is not only the writer of the introduction, but also his research on the Utah War and all of the involvements of the church with the administration is widely called upon, with Pauli's thanks in this book, and it adds another of its great valuable components, I think. So that's another very, very good thing. Well, I'd like to say something in connection with the business on murder, castration, etc., which has risen its ugly head, has raised its ugly head here several times. I had a discussion with Rick Turley about this particular subject after I'd been reading another defector's account, one by a Swiss convert. And his comments were quite interesting to me, and I wonder whether you think he's heaping leaves over the situation. He said that. He said, how many specific instances can you think of? And he came up with the number of all of the brutal cases that have been named by name here, which is always followed by, and many other murders. And said, compare that number to the number that you find in any other early settlement, which is limited law enforcement and feels very much under pressure from the outside world. How do you think that compares? Well, I have no idea, but he said, it's really a very small amount of violence compared to other frontier communities. That's one interesting point. Another item I brought up to him at that time was that this other family, which was leaving Utah under stress, the husband and wife had to escape and walk 25 miles over the mountains, try and get to Wyoming. And later, the rest of their family, who had to travel in a wagon, followed along afterwards. And after they got about as far as Bear Lake, they were overtaken by some of the officials from Salt Lake City. And these officials called for the leader of the wagon train to come over and discuss things with him. And the children all hid under the wagon, sure that he was going to be shot at this point. But what they did instead was take the best wagon, the best yoke of oxen, and load up in that wagon all of the goods that they wanted, that these former settlers were taking away with them. And I asked Rick, I said, what about that? And he said, those must have been debts from the perpetual emigrating fund that these people were probably still in debt to Salt Lake before their journey over in the first place, that Salt Lake settlers were in such bad shape that they had to follow everything that was leaving the colony as well as those things coming in, and that they just couldn't afford to let anybody go. They asked all the young people who had been baptized in the church whether they were really interested in leaving or if they really wanted to stay. They all said they wanted to go, and no one was shot or killed. Now, this gave me some kind of a limiting reaction to the kind of talk on violence that we hear when we talk about this subject. I wonder if anybody would like to make any comments on this violence. Bill?
I think Rick's point is well taken in terms of statistics, although it is interesting to note that the body count in Utah during the late 1850s was roughly comparable to that in its neighbor to the east, which earned that neighbor the enduring nickname Bleeding Kansas. The difference between violence in Utah and violence in Montana or Arizona or Kansas was the central direction and tone that was established by the governor of the territory. In Montana, the violence took the form of vigilantism against robbers in the gold fields, and they were individual acts perpetrated by bands of vigilantes. Same was true in California. The difference was that in Utah, you had the sworn territorial governor standing up in front of large numbers of people, 3,000 in some cases, on a Sunday morning, in advocating lethal violence. There's a discourse published in the Deseret News in May of 1853, in which the governor of this territory argued that the proper way to deal with thieves caught was through summary execution, and went on to describe how he would blow thieves from the mouth of a cannon, which is what the British Army did in 1857 during the Indian Mutiny when they caught mutineers in India. And he went on at some length, very graphically, commenting that he knew it would be counter to the teachings and the upbringings of many of the people in the audience, that immediate summary execution, no trial, no arrest, no jury, was the way to deal with thieves in his territory. That wasn't the only time that was said. So the thing that was different in Utah was a tone to the society established from the very top of it about killing, to the point where a vocabulary arose in Utah quite differently than other places in the American West in terms of the code words that were used. There was one that I recall, the term was to NEPO somebody. NEPO is the word open spelled backwards, and it was a code term for eviscerating an enemy and then sinking them in a lake or stream, filling the chest cavity with rocks. That became fairly common in the territory, and again, the principal civil and religious leaders used terms like that quite frequently, even in religious discourses. So I think that the difference wasn't so much the statistics, although, as I say, the body count in Utah was very similar to that in what was called Bleeding Kansas. It was the tone set from the top by a sworn territorial governor who had access to a printing press, the Deseret News, for example, and to large audiences to dispense what could be interpreted as negative leadership. That's different than accusing those leaders of murder, but it is commenting on the tone that their personal leadership extended to the area that they were sworn to protect and defend, down to the last individual.
Claudia?
Holly?
I think, is this on? Yeah. I think one difference, major difference, is that after studying this for a long time now and trying to understand these murders and why Brigham Young did not go out and try and find the offenders and immediately try them and set an example, and that maybe other murders in the future would not have happened, he did not do any of that. And instead, he was preaching to blood atone those who were not faithful, who were leaving the faith, or who were questionable individuals. And it was all tied up in the millennial beliefs that he had. He truly believed that the coming of the army to Utah was the first step in the coming of the millennium. And this was a big deal. He talks about it again and again and again, and that God will, you know, this is the time. God is coming. And we need to be ready and pure. And, you know, the catechism that was held during the Reformation of all your sins that you needed to confess and be rebaptized is all part and parcel of the same thing. And in that sense, I think it's extremely different from the violence held in that was done in, as Bill points out, in mining camps or other pretty lawless places. Utah had an exceptional organization top down with leaders who were all responding to Brigham Young. And, you know, Stegner points out there was a police state. Brigham Young had people reporting to him about what was going on in their wards all over the territory. And so it was a completely different situation. I can see it's tempting to make this analogy that this is just, you know, out the West and in the early days of it, but I really think there's much more of a religious connotation that has not been studied and really needs to be studied about the whole concept of the millennium. And then what changed it? When did the millennium stop being looked at as happening next month?
Okay, another question?
Well, I have one point about the Swiss family that escaped. There are records of who owed the Perpetual Emigrating Company, and I think that could either be fairly quickly established. Did this family, did they owe the church still? Or was it that they felt threatened in some way? I mean, obviously, I've forgotten his name. I know
Frederick Loba.
Yeah.
Frederick Loba.
Oh, yeah, Loba, yeah. I mean, Loba had disagreements with Brigham Young. Young wanted him to make gunpowder. He was a chemist.
He had disagreements, but he kept them very quiet. He really did try not to make trouble, but he was suspected.
Yeah.
So he realized.
And it was pretty desperate measures he took. He and his pregnant wife, right, who left, climbed over the mountains, off the path, because they were afraid they would be pursued. And then the ones that came in the wagon, the oldest son was only, 12 or something. It was pretty scary for this one boy with younger children.
They really thought it was the end, but it wasn't.
I think there are two sides to the Frederick Loba case, and Polly and I may not agree on which side we take, but Loba and his wife were the apostates that fled Utah and left behind, I think, seven children who came along separately a year later. Loba's story was told to a New York Times reporter in Kansas during the summer of 1856, and the reporter was a very flamboyant, notorious reporter who was later assassinated in the offices of the Times in New York City because of a marital tiff that he had with someone else. Or someone else had with him. So I'd say the reporting of the Loba experience through that reporter in Kansas, which is what hit the Eastern newspapers, could be questioned in many respects. And then if you go back into Loba's correspondence with Brigham Young, you see still another story. I mean, Brigham Young poured money into an operation for Frederick Loba to make gunpowder in Utah. Utah did not then have the capability for it, and one of the preparations for the Utah War was the mining of lead at Las Vegas and an attempt to create gunpowder in Utah, which really didn't succeed, so it was imported from San Francisco and St. Louis. Loba strayed in his mission for Brigham Young, and instead of making gunpowder, he went into the business of distilling bourbon. And he got caught up in that, and his correspondence with Brigham Young sort of abjectly confessing that he was in the the distillation of spirits rather than the manufacturing of gunpowder gives you a very interesting side of the Brigham Young-Frederick Loeb relationship, which doesn't quite make it into the interviews with the New York Times reporter in Kansas in the summer of 1856. So you get a feel that there are at least two sides to the Frederick Loeb story.
It was published in 58, I think, though, in New York, so it wasn't before that. So he's long gone before that news article gets out.
Yes, it was. He was long out of Utah at that point.
But he was also making hand lotion and other kinds of things, soap, all sorts of things. I guess he didn't. And what I read was that he was given this burnt molasses from which he could distill spirits. And,
yeah.
You know, this is one failure of the economy working for the benefit of another one.
Well, it was partly the trying to make sugar. And they weren't able to make good sugar from the sugar beets, and they had all this molasses that then he
was able to use. Which is the story I was telling first. That's what Joseph Edibles Vernon could not do was make sugar, you know.
Yeah.
But that's another story. What do we have? Do we have any further questions for Polly on this, or for any of our... Yes, Richard.
I had a conversation with Steve Sorensen, who was now deceased, who was once one of the leaders of the church history department. And he said that he was pretty sure that there was sort of a gangs of thugs in New York, in Salt Lake City, who were sort of Brigham Young's enforcers, that he could call upon them when he needed some kind of, someone intimidated. He didn't talk about murder, but he talked about intimidation of various sorts. And I'm just wondering what kind of evidential base there is for that sort of thing. Is it just these sort of shadowy organizations are so hard to pin down? I'm wondering where would you go to find evidence of the gang of thugs?
Evidence of the gang of thugs.
Brigham Young collection in church archives.
Okay, that's give me a little specific.
Brigham Young's correspondence is full of references to these people. There was an Irish gang in the Five Points District of New York called the Boys, B'HOYS, and that morphed into Boys. And that was the term that was used in Utah, not Danites. And I don't think the Danites existed in Utah, but what did exist was what Richard has just described, is a group of the Boys or Boys. And they would hang out in the office, and they would be given assignments, and there would be references in correspondence to take several of the Bohois and take care of a situation. So it wasn't imaginary.
And it included Porter Rockwell and yes. A lot of the other ones.
Now, in the case of Bill Hickman, he went over the top in his behavior in such an extreme fashion that he was later, especially when he went to work for the Army at Fort Douglas in 1863, that Brigham Young severed all of his connections with Hickman. But prior to that time, Hickman was in good standing with Brigham Young to the point that in January of 1857, Hickman was nominated to the president to be U.S. attorney for the territory of Utah. And in the summer of 1858, Brigham Young offered through Daniel H. Wells, his second counselor, his willingness to pay all of Bill Hickman's personal debts to the Gentile mercantile firms in Salt Lake City. So the standing of these individuals, and there were maybe 10 or 12 of them, it wasn't just Bill Hickman or Porter Rockwell, it was Howard Egan and 10 other people perhaps. Their standing, and in some cases cryptic references to their assignments, are in the Brigham Young collection.
The Hosea Stout journals are really good on this, too.
And Young Loeb describes them in a contemporary reference as having red topknots. They had long hair, and they had it worn in topknots, and they tied ribbons with red strings. So they identify themselves. So
I'm not sure that's accurate, Corey. I mean, I think that's a Loeb.
Contemporary.
That's a Loeb liberty, I think, detail.
Maybe sometime. for ceremonial occasions, they wore this wig. Yes, Paul.
Leonard Arrington, in his biography of Brigham Young, talks about Brigham Young's Minutemen, he called them, or the Bahois. And it was the same group. So I figure if Leonard talks about them, when he really doesn't include anything about the Reformation in his biography or about the various murders, or even I don't think he talks about Mountain Meadows. So I have to believe there's some pretty good substantial evidence that Leonard felt he had for it.
So have we got another question for Polly or for our commentators?
I'd like to ask a question that I've been asked about my book. Could you give us just a little background about what it was, an autobiography of Polly writing the book, and if there were any breakthroughs in your research, like a key document or something like that?
Oh, definitely there was. When I started this, I just had my grandmother's account of what happened to the family. She wrote it when she was in her 80s. And it was based on her mother, who was one of the ones who escaped in 1859. Her mother had been dead for 40 years, so this is her memory. And it includes a lot of, she was a very good writer, it's very engaging. But the more I did research, the more I realized that many of these stories, I could find no basis, in fact, for none whatsoever. She had the outline right. They had converted in Scotland. They had come to Utah. They had lived in Salt Lake City. They had moved south, which ended up being Spanish Fork. And they had an army escort to help them escape Utah. So that was basically correct. But she also said that the reason the family had converted was not because they had become good Mormons, but that they had been told by the missionaries that they were building a new society in Utah that was not based on birth, aristocracy, money, and everybody would be given land, and that they were a very idealistic family that wanted to reform society, and that's what attracted them. Well, the more I dug, the more I realized that can't be true, because here's Peter McGoslin, made a priest, and then he's out baptizing people, and there was just too much evidence that they were honest, good, honest, sincere Mormons. So then I began to work on this just as a family biography, because I didn't have the writings of anybody except what my grandmother had written. And with my children, we camped on the Overland Trail from the Mississippi River all the way over to Salt Lake City, following the route, more or less, that the Mormons had taken. And then later on with a friend, we went from Salt Lake City to California, the route they had taken through Nevada. And we ended up where they settled, which was near Marysville or Yuba City, north of Sacramento. And my friend was a good travel companion, but not all that interested in my family history. So I didn't want to, spend too much time in this area in California where they had settled. And so I just decided to look up in the phone book to see if there were any remaining cousins there. Because the one I ended up writing about was Peter McGoslin, my great-great-uncle. So I had a little family tree, and one of them was named Ansel Miller, and I thought, well, there can't be too many Ansel Millers around, and so I looked it up in the phone book, and by gum, there was an Ansel Miller. So I took down the phone number, and when I got home, I called him and told him who I was. Well, he knew who I was, because my father had actually gone to try and find some of the family history there, and he said, my daughter is very interested in all the papers that are in the trunk. And I said, the trunk? What trunk is this?
The trunk of the attic.
Well, I had been to this place before and visited an elderly cousin who lived in the same place that Peter McGoslin homesteaded. And in the building was apparently somewhat the same, had been remodeled a lot. And she had told me all she had was a photograph on the wall of one part of the family, and she had a tiny little notebook about homesteading in California. And so she said, there are no other papers. But when this cousin died and the family had come in, and she had no children, and so the other relatives had come in, they found this. It was actually a plywood box, but the size of a trunk. And it was filled with Peter McGosselin's books and draft letters that he wrote, and essays, and various other bits and pieces. There was a tiny little leather shoe that their first son died in Salt Lake City, and I think this must have been his. And so so I quickly got in touch with his daughter, Ansel's daughter, whose name was Donna Ferguson. And she teaches at a community college, and she was really interested in this, and she had begun to transcribe some of the writings. A lot of them were moth-eaten, mouse-eaten probably. They had holes in them. Some were quite faded. They'd been written on any kind of paper he could get hold of. I mean, paper bags, pieces of cardboard that then were rolled up. And so she would transcribe them, and then she would send them to me, and I would say, you know, I think this may be this person's name, and give a first name or something, or that this should be spelled this way, and she'd go back and check. And then she photographed a lot of these documents for me and sent them to me. And then I went down to visit her twice, and we went through these documents, and so now I have this collection of Peter McGosselin's papers. So suddenly I had a voice, his voice, of what had happened to him. Well, then one day Donna called me and she said, I've just been over at my father's house and he's shredding old papers, and including some deeds to the land. And then there was one letter, and she said, I think it's important. And it turned out to be the critical letter, which is in the book, in the epilogue. He had written to a friend in Scotland whom he had baptized, and this friend was still hoping to emigrate to Utah. And obviously this friend had written to him and said, why have you left the church? And this is his answer. And it's a four-page letter written on a kind of ledger paper, and it talks about the murder of the parishes in Springville when the family was living in Spanish Fork, just 6 miles away, and the need for obedience. So, and then I found out that this Peter was the first in the family to convert, and the first to start having doubts. And so he became my central figure. And so that just made all the difference.